Months ago, at least 2 months ago anyway, we had the pleasure of talking with some people from OTC Enterprises, Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. We had the pleasure of talking with Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises, and Norman Colton. We've asked these gentlemen to join us again this morning. We're interested in what they had to say. We've received quite a lot of mail. And I am interested in finding out something about Mrs. Margaret Storm. When I say I'm interested in finding out something about her, she was with us on the party line before, I think about 6 or 8 months ago. At that time, we were told about something about a radio machine, I think it was called that Tesla had invented. And it seems that Mrs. Storm was in contact with somebody who lived in England, and this person who resided in England had a contact with Tesla, who died in the late 30s. So my guest this morning, Mrs. Margaret Storm, author of the book to be published in the next few weeks, it'll be released. It's entitled Return of the Dove. Otis T. Carr, Norman Colton, Charles Leadham, author and TV producer, and Ellery Lanier, the fact editor of Fantastic Science Fiction, will be with us in a brief period of time.
And we have a new gentleman with us this morning, new to the party line, Don Dunn of Television Age. There's a couple of more people. We might as well introduce everybody, huh? And my cousin, Rodney Dexter. Let's get it started this way. Mrs. Storm, I wonder if you can tell us what your connection is with OTC Enterprises.
Well, when I was writing Return of the Dove, I had almost completed the book when I learned that Mr. Otis T. Carr, had been one of Tesla's disciples, so to speak, and had been trained by Tesla. And since I was writing about other persons who knew Tesla, I asked Mr. Carr to come up and see me, and after we talked over his work, I decided that he belonged in the book. So I had a nice place between the last two chapters, so we just tucked him in there.
You say that Otis T. Carr was a disciple of Tesla?
Yes, and I...
Do you mean when you use that word... Do you mean that he was employed by Tesla?
Well, I use that word specifically because when I first started to do research for this book, Prodigal Genius, which was written by John J. O'Neill, was one of the books in which I was the most interested. And John O'Neill made quite a point of the fact that when Tesla died in 1943, that his work was completely finished because he left no disciples, that is, no one who was interested in carrying on his specific work. So, naturally, in my book, I brought out the point that Tesla left many disciples, persons such as Arthur H. Matthews of Canada and Otis T. Carr, who are carrying on his work very definitely.
In other words, are you saying, Mrs. Storm, that as the author of the book entitled The Return of the Dove, that you spent a considerable amount of time investigating Mr. Carr prior to including him in your book?
No, I didn't spend very much time investigating him. I had heard quite a lot about him. I was not aware that he had a direct connection with Tesla until he came up to see me, and then when I discovered that, I... decided very quickly that his work belonged in the book.
Mr. Carr's work?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us, Mrs. Storm. Of course, we're very fortunate that we have Mr. Carr with us this morning, but I wonder if you could tell us, in your own words, something about Mr. Carr's work.
Well, I do not go into the technical end of this of these matters because that is not my field. And I was interested merely in the fact that back in 1925, Tesla contacted Mr. Carr. Mr. Carr at that time was a package clerk in a hotel here where Mr. Tesla was living, and Mr. Tesla sought him out and asked him to bring 4 pounds of unsalted peanuts to his suite. And when Mr. Carr took the peanuts up there, Mr. Tesla invited him in to talk
the
with
pigeons.
Him. to talk with him, and that was the beginning of his training.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carr, do you agree with that?
Thank you, Long John. What she said is absolutely true. We wish to state that we're very happy to be here tonight. I also want to pay a little bit of tribute to the tremendous audience that you must have. We don't know how many people it is.
About 8.
Well, or we don't know how many states that it covers. But we do know this, that there is an age of awakening, and that you do have a tremendous listening audience. And there must be a reason for it. And we are here to try to bring this reasoning into being. Now, insofar as our association with Mr. Tesla was concerned, he indoctrinated us.
When you say us?
Me.
I say.
Mm-hmm. Into the space age in 1925. We were much younger than we are now. And many things we do not understand. But this great man, this great dedicated genius to humanity, kept enlightening us. He taught us where to go and what to do and how to seek and how to find. And out of this has come our own revolutionary developments. We build upon the shoulders of giants, and Tesla is one of the greatest.
I was just wondering, in looking at your brochure, Mr. Carr, why you didn't include Tesla.
We have included him throughout our brochure. He was a mystical man.
Well, I mean, is it in here someplace? Maybe I might.
It's on the front cover. The Return of the Dove. Tesla always stood for peace, and we put the
dove. You mean because he was feeding pigeons in the hotel room?
Not,
is this the connection?
No. No. Tesla was a man who was dedicated to the edification of humanity.
Yes.
And the dove to him was a symbol of peace. And so we put it on the front cover of our brochure so that it would mystically bring into being, when the time was right, the fact that we are the true developer of the things that he knew he could not bring into being while he was here in this particular transition.
Isn't this sort of a mystical way, though, of giving Tesla credit for anything by just having a dove on the cover of this very beautiful brochure?
Anyone who knew him knew the symbolism.
Uh-huh. Have you recently had another print run on this?
Not recently, no.
About how long ago was the last print run on the
Mr. Colton is in charge of these things.
There have just been two print orders. This
that you have in front of you is the second, and I believe it's the same one you had here before.
I don't remember the dove before.
Oh, yes.
Was it?
Yes, there's been no change of that kind made in the second printing.
I was interested in it.
There's a little improvement in the color distribution on the presses, otherwise...
beautiful brochure. Beautiful. Mr. Dunn. Don, this is the first time that you've joined us. I know that you've listened to a couple of the party line bits.
And now, well, you get a little idea how we sit around and talk for hours. I thought possibly maybe you'd have a question for Mr. Carr, Mrs. Storm, or Mr. Colton, or any one of our guests.
Mr. Tesla is someone I do not know too much about, but I would like to ask what practical discoveries he made toward space flight.
Mr. Tesla, may I interrupt? Mr. Tesla brought into being alternating current, which meant that electricity could be transported over distances, whereas it was confined to short areas due to resistance. Along with this, he developed the Tesla coil. And in order to understand this coil, you must look up a definition of it. I do not care to give it here. This meant possible that the electrical age was born. Prior to the Tesla coil, we had a static electrical age. When this coil was put into practice, it meant that we had spark coils for internal combustion engines. It meant that electricity in its primary and in its secondary circuits became a vital force. This man brought all of these things into being.
What year was the Tesla coil discovered or developed?
At the turn of the century.
Yes, before the turn of the century.
Right. No, you were not associated with him at that time.
Oh, no, not indeed. No.
On 1900.
Charles?
No, I'm still curious why I'm not part of the Nikola Tesla fan club, but how he happened to get sloughed off with only a dove on the cover when there's a whole page in here with Francis Bacon, Luigi Galvani, and who else I quite forget. Oh, Galileo was in here with pictures and a little text. I'm trying to get to the reason that he was only mystically represented in the brochure rather than given maybe a little mention on page 14 or something.
Well, could I say something?
Did you have something to do with the brochure?
No,
oh.
No, but I have.
You have a comment? Go ahead,
just had a comment on that if you'd like to hear it.
Please.
I believe you said there are a number of persons who are interested in promoting the Tesla inventions and so forth now. And it seems that each of us has our work to do, and it apparently was more than a coincidence that I happened to come out with my book, Return of the Dove, at the exact time that Mr. Carr was bringing out his work, which was a combination of Tesla's original development. And, of course, in the past, I've Return of the Dove is the title. Again, that the symbol of the dove is represented. And if you read the book, when you read the book, you will see why the dove was actually more important than Tesla himself.
Again, I just repeat, it's a rather mystical way of giving the man.
Well,
no doubt all of these people are very enthused.
There was so much that could not be explained except in mystical terms, and that is the reason for the emphasis on the dove.
Was he a rather mystical individual?
Oh, yes, definitely so.
Before we get
in... out of this world.
Really was. Looks like we're going to have one that's out of this world tonight, too. We're just warming up. We'll be flying soon. Keep the windows closed, men. Mrs. Storm, before we get back to
OTC Enterprises and Mr. Carr, Mr. Colton. I wonder if you could refresh in my memory, and possibly we may have a couple of listeners who did not have the good fortune of being with us the morning that you told us about the Tesla radio machine, I think that's
Well, it's a radio type set for interplanetary communication.
Could you tell us something about that, please?
Yes. In 1938, Tesla was very interested in space, outer space, and life on other planets, and it was a subject that he seemed to understand quite thoroughly. I have since learned from Mr. Carr that he understood it quite thoroughly, even as far back as 1925. But in 1938, he designed a set, a radio type set for interplanetary communication.
Now, in what was the year again?
1938.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he gave that design to his engineer, Mr. Arthur H. Matthews, who lives near Quebec, Canada. And he said to Mr. Matthews, you don't need to build this now, but he said in a few years, spaceships will be approaching the Earth from other planets. And then you build this set, and you will be able to talk to the crews, the pilots.
In what language?
Well, I guess Mr. Matthews, his first language is English. I believe he also speaks French, but...
did Tesla consider...
I don't...
The possibility, rather remote, naturally, that maybe the occupants of the spacecraft may speak some language that would be foreign to Earthlings?
He seemed to know that they would speak English. At least there was no question of language. So,
That the Venusians or Martians...
That's right.
...would speak English.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Matthews then read about Kenneth Arnold's sightings in 1947, I believe. And so he immediately looked up his notes and set about building the set. In 1948, he had the set completed. So he tuned it in, and he immediately got a spaceship. And they had... 1938, I'm sorry. 1938, Tesla designed the set.
Mm-hmm.
1948, it was built and functioning. You see, Tesla was the father of radio, you might say the grandfather of radio.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was not unusual for him to design a set of this sort. It will not pick up anything closer than 5,000 miles. The ship or whatever it is must be 5,000 miles above the Earth. And the small set which Mr. Matthews built first had a range of up to 30,000 miles. And the first ship that he contacted, he told me, was 25,000 miles above Quebec. And they had quite a conversation with him in this first... contact, but...
You said 25,000 miles?
Miles, uh-huh. The machine has a range of from 5,000 miles to 30,000.
Oh, I see. There is a possibility of reaching a distance of 30,000.
Of 30,000. Mm-hmm. This first machine which Mr. Matthews built is not a full-scale machine. He has since built another one, or is building another one. In other words, this machine, as it stands now, is really not equipped for interplanetary communication because he built the model just at that range of from 5,000 to 30,000 miles.
Of the distance.
Yes.
The problem there.
Mm-hmm. But he can expand the machine so that it can reach to greater distances. It operates not on radio waves at all, but on cosmic rays. And
sometimes we do too.
So in this first conversation that they had, that the space people had with Mr. Matthews, they told him that Tesla himself had been brought here in a spaceship, that he was not born on this planet, and that he had been brought here from Venus in 1856.
Charles Lehman?
This is probably why he knew what language the Venusians would speak. And as I understand, there was a misconception that Tesla was born in Italy, wasn't there?
No, he was born in what is now Yugoslavia.
Oh, I see. I mean, he was put there by
the
spaceship.
He was placed there, yes. It was a very remote mountain province, a tiny village.
And this would prevent curiosity when the spaceship landed.
Yes, and apparently arrangements had been made prior to the landing with Mr. and Mrs. Tesla.
Did Mr. Tesla then speak Venusian English from the time he was born, or did he perhaps forget
no,
after relearn?
I guess he spoke Yugoslavian or whatever, Serbian, I believe they call the language. No, his father was a, that is, his, Mr. Tesla himself was a Serbian, a minister of the Serbian church. And so Tesla grew up in that atmosphere.
May I interrupt?
Surely.
There is a universal language which runs throughout the universe, and this is the language of love. And Tesla knew it very well, and he knew how to communicate without words. And all of us people in this entire universe can so communicate.
How about Matthews up in Canada?
We have never met him.
Well, do you think he had a knowledge of this universal language?
If Mrs. Storm says so, I believe it.
I didn't hear her say it. Did you?
Well, I haven't said it, but I will say it. Yes, he certainly he certainly has. And Mr. Matthews told me, that is, he wrote me one time, he has provided a great deal of material for the book, and I have quite a lengthy chapter in there about him. And at one time, I asked him some question about some communication that he had had from Tesla, and he replied, and he said, well, we didn't always communicate by letter. We had other ways of communicating.
Charles?
I'm curious to know, now that Mr. Carr has brought up this fine linguistic point, when Mr. Matthews spoke to the radio operator of the spaceship, were they speaking English or were they speaking love? Oh, they were speaking English.
They were speaking English,
Now, on this radio, I'm fascinated by the fact that it doesn't work at less than 5,000 miles. I assume this has to be in a straight line so there wouldn't be any inconveniences like taking another set 6,000 miles away on the Earth, and unfortunately it doesn't work.
Well, I don't know that it has to be on a straight line, but Mr. Matthews did tell me this, that he has this set in a certain spot. And the beam, which comes from the ship on which it works, is so fine, it's much finer than the finest hair. And therefore, Mr. Matthews never moves the set, even a quarter of an inch, unless he notifies the space people. Now, he has traveled up to the Yukon and so forth, and he's taken the set along with him, but then he notifies, he has arrangements made with him. Because they have calculations made so that anytime they want to get in touch with him, they know exactly where they're going to tune in.
How does he counteract the revolution of the Earth with this hair-fine beam?
That I wouldn't have any idea. As I say, I don't understand the technical things, and I don't go into them. I know my limitations.
Margaret Storm, the author of the new book entitled Return of the Dove, Otis T. Carr, president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland, Mr. Norman Evans Colton, director of sales engineering of OTC Enterprises, Charles Leadham, author and TV producer, and Don Dunn of Television Age. Charles?
I was looking at the OTC Enterprises brochure, which is said, brings you atoms for peace. And on page...
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
With his car, together. In a section on a little bit of prose on Dr. Einstein, there are two questions on this thing, one about Dr. Einstein, one about Dr. Carr. It says his on Einstein, it says his mass, energy, and time equations have inspired thousands of mechanical developments in science. And I was curious, Mr. Carr, I have not kept up on this sort of thing outside of your own developments. What sort of things, what are these mechanical developments in science that the Einstein equations have developed, inspired?
Dr. Einstein came up with a tremendous observation that there was a fallacy in the velocity of light. And this fallacy was the fact that it was always predicated by the observer. And very brilliant people then took this yardstick, this measuring device that this great man gave to us, and started to build things predicated upon the weakness of the observer and the strength of nature. And we could not begin to tell you or even enumerate the inspiration and the development in the world of science that has come by this tremendous observation of this humble, brilliant, dedicated man. And he has not been given credit, because throughout all of this, he asked nothing for himself. He only spoke one word: peace, and love your neighbor. And we have a tremendous feeling for him. We have met him, we have talked to him, and his great inspiration to us was this phrase that we have used here: if space were infinite, matter could be made to disappear.
Mr. Carr, certainly go along with many of your sentiments there about Dr. Einstein. But when you say you could not begin to enumerate the thousands of mechanical developments which he inspired, I wonder if you wouldn't consider it sort of too time-wasting for the audience if you would enumerate just two or three of them for me, which wouldn't take too much time.
Well,
specific devices which were inspired by the statement of his.
You know, it's a strange thing. I could not recall one.
I see.
Mechanical development. But I know within my being, due to my own researches, that thousands of them have been developed due to his sensitivity in the electrical field. If you'll study encyclopedias, you'll find that in the element, in the finest, highest sense of electrical equations, some have been named after him. The Einstein unit, and some others.
That's my first acquaintance with that with that unit, Mr. Carr.
What is the Einstein unit?
We don't understand. We don't know.
I wouldn't understand it either.
No.
Could you at least tell me, is it large? Is it small?
No.
What is it?
It is a unit of motion in an electrical field.
It's not tangible.
No, it is tangible to the extent that it can be mathematically equated. And he gave the mathematics for it.
Well, as I'm sorry to hear that out of the thousands of mechanical devices which you mentioned, I can understand at short notice you might not be able to think of even one.
Right.
Down on the little section, I know, John, that you dislike extended reading here, but this is only about three or four sentences. I would like to read this quote. I believe it's your quote, Mr. Carr,
right,
opposite your picture, which is billed alongside of Dr. Einstein here.
Underneath it.
Oh, underneath, yes.
Right.
Einstein got top billing. The quote is, the dimensions of pressure are straight line. The dimension of motion is a curvature. Pressure creates motion, and motion creates pressure. Therefore, motion is dimensionally fourth. Finite space is a condition of the field, and the static universe is as real as the kinetic one. From the spawning point of inertia, numerous dimensions beyond the fourth are logically equated. Static or dynamic, all matter is available energy. And to end the quote in capitals, it is as simple as that. And this is the introductory statement for the booklet.
It's a good one.
Right. Are you being critical?
No, I just wanted to...
May we
beyond the fourth dimension.
On the 56th.
Right.
Well, Dr. Einstein, who was a dedicated, brilliant scientist working in mathematics in a physical form, never went into the mystical because he could not get an exploratory answer. However, we do know that there are dimensions beyond the fourth. We have described the fourth dimension in the curvature of motion, which we know it to be true. However, let us go into another dimension. All velocity is predicated upon mass, and all mass has weight. But who amongst us has weighed a dream, or who has measured its intensity, or who has measured its choice of distance? This is another dimension. The dream is as real as you and I sitting here. And yet, no laboratory has ever come up and said it weighed 1 gram, 2 grams, 1 centimeter, or so forth. Therefore, we know that within our consciousness, within our minds, are dimensions beyond the physical, which is truly expressed by the poet. So, Dr. Einstein knew this, but he had too much mathematics for what was physical. So he did not explore beyond. But the great Tesla did. I was his student, and I know he could create matter with thought, believe it or not. And we have seen it done. And we may be the only living person who has seen it done, but we have.
Mr. Carr, this 3-year discipleship of yours with Mr. Tesla, I noticed, I think it was in Mrs. Storm's book where she would, was it in your book or in a release where
yes.
it was related that
it was
called the
book.
Sponge by
yes.
by Mr. Tesla, or Dr. Tesla, I guess it was, wasn't it?
Well, yes.
I wonder, Mr. Carr, if this relationship, which to his contemporaries and associates may have seemed odd, that of an eminent scientist, and I think at that time it was said you were a delivery boy for a department store.
Oh, that's total non-entity.
Did this excite any comment among his associates, or did perhaps they not know about it?
Absolutely not. Mr. Tesla was a master of situations, and this situation he built in order that I would carry on. This one problem, this one thing that has to be solved, man's entering into space as a true entity rather than being blasted into it.
So, in effect, none of his associates or contemporaries knew about this curious relationship between Dr. Tesla and yourself.
There wasn't anything curious about it. He was a master.
It was unusual, let's put it that way.
Well, let's make it unusual. He was a master, and the master had a task to perform, and he chose me to be the vessel.
In fact, it was, you might say that it was almost a secret relationship, that no one would have known about it if you hadn't revealed it to Mrs. Storm.
We have revealed it prior to Mrs. Storm. Storm, I never knew Mrs. Storm when she wrote the title, The Return of the Dove. Nevertheless, we had already expended all of our energies producing this brochure, which, if you will notice the cover, shows a dove returning. Not going away, it is returning.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a symbolism here that is tremendous.
Well, the point that I am perhaps boringly trying to get at is that this very interesting story about him revealing many of the secrets of his researches to you is not the sort of thing that might have been mentioned in journals or memoirs or things of other people, that in fact you might very well not find the Carr-Tesla relationship mentioned anywhere in any documents or recollections. It comes only from yourself, in other words, and Mr. Tesla, unfortunately, being dead, can't comment on it.
Could I
Mr. Storm, please do.
I might say that this same question has been brought up in connection with Mr. Matthews.
Mm-hmm.
There, again, was a strange relationship because when Mr. Tesla first, at the request of Lord Kelvin, went to England to consult with Lord Kelvin about what they called the wireless at that time, radio, there he met Mr. Matthews, father and son. Now, Arthur H. Matthews, who is now, I guess, a man in the 70s in Canada, was at that time just a boy, and his father was an electrical engineer working with Lord Kelvin. Yet, Mr. Tesla took such an interest in this boy that he taught Arthur Matthews everything that he knows about electrical engineering. Now, Arthur Matthews is today a professional electrical engineer, but he has had no engineering training aside from...
He has no formal degrees or training of that
No,
sort.
He has no. He has had no formal training whatsoever, and yet he passed the examinations and became an electrical engineer. This was all because of his association with Tesla.
Mr. Carr, are you familiar with the name Major Joseph Markoff?
No.
Never heard of Major Markoff?
Not to my knowledge or memory.
I just wondered because I've been told that Major Joseph Markoff for a period of time was associated with Tesla, and he has, I think you met Major
yes,
Markoff, did
yes.
you, Mrs. Storm?
I did.
One morning?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's been on the party line a number of times, and he has told us some things about Tesla. I might also say that our engineer, Mr. Nielsen, wrote an article about Tesla, too. So he's quite familiar with Tesla. Mr. Dunn, you seem to have a book there.
I have a reference? Yes, a book called Particle Genius, The Life of Nikola Tesla. This book apparently was written by the science editor of the New York Herald Tribune right after Tesla's death in 43. It seems to have a very complete index. I was just wondering, in this index are listed the names of many people that Tesla came in contact with. Mr. O'Neill, who wrote the book, is quoted as having many years of personal friendship with Tesla, and Tesla once told him, "You understand me better than any man alive." I was just wondering, is the fact that Mr. Carr and Mr. Matthews' name not mentioned in the index, is this some sort of an oversight?
No, I think, Don, that Mr. Carr explained it fully. He said that no one else knew of the relationship between him and Tesla, and the fact that all word of this relationship came from Mr. Carr. Mr. Tesla never mentioned it. Mr. O'Neill never mentioned it. No one, in fact, had ever known of it before Mr. Carr was good enough to put it down.
The same thing with Mr. Matthews?
I think this may have been the same thing, yes. I mean, if anyone were to say to Mr. Matthews, for example, "I don't think you ever knew Mr. Tesla," it would be just a matter of, you would have to believe Mr. Matthews, but there'd be no corroboration.
Well, there would be corroboration in the fact that Mr. Matthews, of course, has many, many letters, drawings, a great deal of material from Tesla.
Mr. Matthews has this sort of material.
Oh, yes, Mr. Matthews has all the designs for the Tesla anti-war machine and all of that. That was all turned over to him, entrusted to him.
This brings up an interesting point. I wonder, Mr. Carr, if Mr. Tesla left any sort of memorabilia with you of this sort.
There's a question. I have nothing from Mr. Tesla except his instructions of the things that we were to do. We spent many hours, 5, 6, and 7 hours a day in the Museum of Natural History in New York from the period of 1925 to 1928. We also spent many hours in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Our education was directed by this great genius along certain lines. He took us into the Museum of Natural History and said, "Do you wish to see a visitor from space?" This was about 1926. I said I most assuredly was.
That's what took you in where, sir?
Into the Museum of Natural History in New York, and he said, would you like to see a visitor from space? And I said, well, I most assuredly would. And he says, well, here is a meteor that weighs about 66,000 pounds that was discovered by Commodore Perry on one of his expeditions into the far north. And he brought it back in the hold of the ship. It is probably the largest exhibited meteor on the face of this earth. And it is truly a messenger from space. He said, now this meteor is of almost pure iron, almost 90% pure iron. And he says, our foundries cannot, our blast furnaces cannot produce anywhere near its quality. And he says, I want you to study this visitor from space and see if you cannot get a message here. So then he left me. And so we studied this meteor. We felt it. We looked at its craters, and we felt the slick side of iron that was sawed off to show that it was almost pure iron, almost 91%. And still we had a doubt, so one day we slipped in a hammer and we took a crack at it, and wham, we were run, because it made a terrific ringing sound, and we thought maybe we had damaged something. However, this is a part of our education directed to this great man.
Well, I've been let down just a little bit for a moment there. I was, sort of going with you there when you mentioned something about a space visitor. Is this what you refer to, you label as a space visitor?
It was, yes. This meteor came from outside our atmosphere.
Mr. Carr, apparently I wasn't listening close enough. Where was this meteorite when you gave it a belt with the hammer?
In the basement of the Museum of Natural History, and I hope they don't catch up with me.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt at this time, but we're going to have to take care of a little business.
Sir Colton, I wonder if you would tell our eight listeners and the people sitting around the table this morning, Mr. Dunn and Mr. Leedham, who are not familiar with OTC Enterprises, I wonder if you can tell us something about that corporation.
When it was incorporated, the reason for it being formed,
and how far you've progressed up to the present time.
The OTC corporations were set up in 1955. Of course, my first introduction to them was in June of 1957. They were more or less what you might call paper corporations up to that time. And I was brought into the picture when Mr. Carr was ready to put some of these discoveries and accomplishments, policies and objectives on paper. And he, talked with me about producing these brochures and the other literature that you've seen here so that we could get the message started on its way out to the public. So in June of 57, we began work on these brochures and this other literature, and I began studying the inventions of Otis Carr. Began to learn a little bit myself about the natural science and the physics involved, the basic principles, so that I learned while doing what had preceded this time in the 20 years of Mr. Carr's researches and developments, and also the history of the corporations and what they were setting out to do. So from June of 57 until the present time, just about a year, we have informed a great number of people that OTC Enterprises is the parent corporation of two subsidiaries. One is Kuroda Dynamics, the other is Neutron Atomic Development. each of which, as a subsidiary of the parent corporation, is set up to do specific research and development.
Are all of these corporations dormant, or are they activated at the present time?
In the ordinary commercial sense, they are dormant because they are not doing business by selling products. They are quite active in the field of communication and in organizing.
Do they pay taxes?
Pardon?
Do they pay taxes?
They pay the required taxes on
corporate
corporations,
taxes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But, I'm not trying to be personal.
No, they're
financial.
There are no taxes on commodities because there are no commodities
mm-hmm.
being sold.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, as I understand it, the taxes are state tax commission taxes
mm-hmm.
on.
How many corporations
are involved in this setup?
A total of these three. OTC Enterprises, which is the parent corporation, the holding corporation.
Of the three.
Of the three.
Mm-hmm.
The two subsidiaries, each of which will have a definite assignment in one field. Kuroda Dynamics will develop the Kuroda gravity motors, which are essentially to be used in stationary applications for very large power outputs. They are machines.
Who invented this?
I beg your pardon?
Who invented it? This
the
motor.
The Kuroda gravity motors.
Mm-hmm.
All of the inventions, the basics and the supplementary inventions from these basics are Mr. Carr's inventions.
And patents? There are patents on all of these inventions?
There is patent procedure in process on all the inventions.
Mm-hmm.
The Kuroda gravity motor is an entirely different category of energy machine from the devices that will be developed and refined and perfected by the Utron Atomic Development Corporation, which will deal with the electromagnetic circular motion machines, whose primary application will be as propulsion power packages for craft or for vehicles,
mm-hmm.
but which in certain situations can also be effective as energy-producing machines.
Mr. Colton, I think you said, Mr. Colton, that you joined OTC Enterprises.
You became associated with Mr. Carr in the early part of 57, is that right, sir?
That's right, in June of 57.
June of 57. And prior to the time that you became associated with Mr. Carr, were these other corporations in existence at that time?
Yes, they were.
What was the first corporation that was formed? The name of it?
I would presume it was OTC Enterprises.
The parent corporation was formed
prior to my acquaintance with Mr.
Well, I mean, you are Director of Sales Engineering. I thought you had some knowledge of the corporations as they stand today.
Well, they were all three formed at approximately the same time. It was in a short space of time.
Well, now we have the Corrado gravity motor.
Right.
And then we have the Utron and the Atomic Development Corporation, is that right?
It is Utron Atomic Development Corporation.
Utron. Oh, I see. Utron Atomic Development Corporation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, these three corporations have the rights to the patents when they are granted?
That is correct.
And has application been made with the United States Patent Office for patents on all of these devices?
Applications have been made on the basics. You see, there are essentially two systems involved here. One system operates on the pressure energy of gravity keyed to motion. That is the basic principle of the Kuroda gravity motor system.
Would you say that again?
Devices built on the principle of the pressure energy of gravity weight keyed to motion.
Gee, it didn't do that much good even when you did it again. But continue, please.
speed. Neutron atomic development systems will be based on electrified circular motion machines employing the free space energies of gravity, magnetism, solar pressures of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
They are two distinctly separate basics. Now, from those basics, many thousands of specific applications will be designed, as we have said in the brochure, from hearing aids to spacecraft, from electrified lawnmowers to ocean liners.
But I think we missed,
or rather, I appreciate the fact that you're telling us more about these various corporations. Again, I repeat the question, are patents pending on all of these devices, sir, at the present time?
No, patents are applied for on the basics.
Well,
but
how many basics do we have?
Two basics. Right.
There
are very broad basics, which are very general, which are completely novel, unique, new, and original.
Is it a waste of money to even bother to have them patented if they're that broad?
May I answer this?
Surely.
To a certain extent, we are not interested in patents. We're interested in the betterment of mankind. We are introducing a new energy system in the same manner in which steam brought in a new energy system, the internal combustion engine brought in a new energy system, incandescent light brought new enlightenment to us. To these same things we are dedicated. We are following the proper procedure of patent applications, not to have a monopoly, but just to keep somebody else from stopping us. We don't care whether we own a patent or not.
We didn't want to stop somebody, though.
No, I said to keep somebody else from stopping us.
Oh, I see.
All we want to do is introduce the system. We will follow the law in this procedure. We are not seeking monopoly in any extent. Therefore, the drawings that you see of our six assembly of building units of the Space Research Institute, you'll note specifically that we say research. Here we will bring into being the applications of these uses, and we'll allow all manufacturers the right to produce them.
Will you charge them a license fee?
We will try to maintain ourselves. We are not seeking a monopoly, neither are we seeking to gain a dynasty.
How will you be able to finance the research?
The financing of the research of all of this activity will be done by an interested public.
Charles Lee.
I'm not sure if I should direct this to Mr. Codd or Mr. Colton, but although I am not an expert, certainly on patent law, I've done considerable reading in this, and it's my understanding that the basic forces of nature are fairly unpatentable. And yet here you are filing patent applications on what you yourself are...
Only on procedures, not on basics.
Oh, well, then Mr. Colton was perhaps in error when he said on basics.
Not necessarily in error.
The point is this, when you
bring novelty, you are allowed patent. Patent means to make public. It means that your right to make public something gives you a document that, you know, according to our law in this country, is 17 years of protection of a form of monopoly or licensing. Now, frankly, the age in which we are in is accelerating beyond this type of development. The patent service has been a beautiful thing up until the present. But now we're in a different age. We're in an age of the H-bomb and the A-bomb, the fission and fusion, the atom, and a terrific amount of political confusion on the face of this earth.
Confusion about patents?
Confusion about living.
Oh, I see.
Period. Right. The only other thing that I would like to say about this is that we are dedicated to bringing into being
A new system, the same as the incandescent light. There will be some rewards for us due to our following the procedure of the law, but we cannot control all of this force. We know it. We cannot control it any more than we control Mr. Tesla's production of the first hydroelectric dam on Earth. Other people built dams. He got a reward. We will get one, according to our deserts.
As I interpret what you just said, Mr. Carr, that you feel that the government is now receptive to patent applications on, or applications for patents on the basic forces of nature, such as gravity and gravity pressure and so forth.
The mechanical developments that bring them into being are patentable.
But not forces, the forces.
No.
I see.
You cannot, there is a force within an incandescent light that is not patentable, believe me.
This is what I thought.
Electricity. Right.
Well, now, in other words, you have filed patent applications on these mechanical developments.
Right.
I see. And I understand from your brochure that the a patent application on the Utron electric accumulator was filed in 1949, some 7 years ago.
That is true.
Has the government given any indication of rejection, or has it just sort of lain fallow for 7 years?
We dropped action on it when we run into the various things that happen to an individual who by himself tries to process something without sufficient funds. We let the action lay idle and then formed our corporations, and now we will explore this patent for all of its value.
In other words, at the present time, the patent application is not in. It has been dropped.
And the processes are in being.
What does that mean exactly? Do you think about it?
When I say the processes are in being, we have fulfilled the law.
And what does that mean, sir?
This is a rather technical question.
I wonder, could you sort of clerk, put it in simple terms for me?
Simple terms is this. That if you invent something and you can prove its novelty, you deserve to gain your reward, and we are following this procedure.
Thank you very much, sir. Well, I am not really with this patent thing, not being as familiar as you are with the processes of patent applications and so forth. But at the present time, is there actually a patent application in the hands of the government on the Utron electric accumulator?
A patent application was filed in 1949, which gave all of the basics.
Which you withdrew, as I understand.
I did not withdrew it.
Well, what did you just say about that, sir?
I just said that when I could not proceed with the action, I stopped. I am now proceeding again.
I see. Thank you.
Pardon me a moment, but I've just got to get in here and take care of a little business for our benefactors. And
Mr. Carr, I understand there are three separate corporations, the OTC Enterprises, the Corrado, and the Utron. Do you have the title of president or director of each of these?
We are the president and chairman of the board of directors of all three corporations. Now, OTC Enterprises is the holding company. They own all of our rights, our trademarks, our copyrights, our patent applications, and our total right to do business is owned by this corporation. All of my developments and my inventions have been assigned to this corporation. In turn, the basic inventions, the basic developments, will be processed for licensing to other manufacturers by the subsidiaries. And the OTC Enterprises will in turn, for a return from these subsidiary corporations, allow them the right to operate.
I see. As chairman on the board, how many board members are there?
We have five directors in each corporation.
I see. Do you have any stockholders?
The private offering and the private participation up to this moment includes some stock ownership in the original OTC Enterprises, but there has not been any public offering of stock.
May I ask what a share of stock would sell for?
The par value of the stock is $1. We are negotiating with a brokerage firm who is preparing a prospectus for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And when we are properly qualified to do, our subsidiary stock will probably go on the market at $10 a share.
Let me interrupt for just a moment here. I can assure you that this discussion is not necessarily an offering of the stock to our listeners. And any statements that are made this morning, for that matter, any morning by any of our guests, are not necessarily the opinions of yours truly, L.J., the management of WOR, the Mutual Network, or any of their affiliates. Continue, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you. I'm just interested in finding out the number of people connected with OTC Enterprises. Yourself and five directors.
That's right.
Might I ask, who did the technical writing on this very beautiful brochure?
Mr. Colton and myself collaborated on it. I gave him the basics, and he expanded them from technical research into the beautiful phraseology and the physical representation is his. He is a qualified genius in this field, we feel.
As a qualified,
you one and all.
As a qualified genius,
does either Mr. Colton or yourself have a degree from a recognized school in engineering?
For myself, our education has been extremely informal. Nevertheless, insofar as knowing what has been done by others, our education exceeds much of the college curricula of the present, we feel, because of our association with the great minds who create. We have had direct association. We have had guidance in learning. We have done research at Columbia University and New York University, but we do not hold any college degrees.
Mr. Carr, if I may get in here for a moment. A statement of yours, Don, just a moment. When you said that your plural knowledge of the work of others was in excess of that of those who have formal degrees. There's an area of physical knowledge that you might fill me in on. I have been looking at these very attractive pages here where there are sketches of Copernicus and Edison and Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here under Galileo that he was the first to observe that the natural behavior of moving bodies is to accelerate at equal rate. And this is something which I missed in my college physics courses, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that to me about the natural behavior of bodies being to accelerate.
I asked Mr. Colton to make research on this, and he read a half a dozen books. And out of it, we came up with this one sentence. Would you like to answer that, Mr. Colton?
Well, for the single statement under each of these illustrations on this page that you're looking at, as Mr. Carr says, I spent many hours with the various books that relate to the work of these men. And tried to put as a picture caption the one most significant summation that would relate to their work, that would stand up as probably at least one of the greatest accomplishments of their lifetime of researches.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the one that was ascribed to Copernicus.
You mean Galileo?
Galileo, excuse me.
In other words, beyond that, you're unable to elaborate. You picked this out of a book which you happen to be reading.
That's right.
I see. Well, I wonder, Mr. Carr, if, as your associate Professor just quoted this from a book. If you, from your knowledge, your personal knowledge of these principles of physics, could elaborate for me on the fact that moving bodies accelerate at an equal rate.
There is a relativity in all matter, and of course,
the moon tower of Pisa, the small weight was dropped, and the very heavy weight was dropped, and they found out that bodies accelerate at something like 32 feet a second, and this begun a knowledge of this momentum of acceleration. Now, to expand on it is beyond my memory of the moment, but my consciousness is very clear about it. I do not need it in my work at the present.
I see. I notice you also have a quote on Isaac Newton, who was, as you say, quite correctly the first to observe the inertial constants of universal bodies. I wonder if perhaps I would assume this sort of thing is moderately important. Do you are you familiar with, or could you quote for me, the Newton's three laws of motion?
We understand thoroughly almost the total observation of Mr. Newton. He has been one of our, one whom we sought to find out something about this kind of universe in which we live. So many people do not understand his great knowledge of the refraction of light, his discovery that the triangular prismatic condition, which allows for dispersion of light into its component spectrum, which is possible to invent the spectroscope, which is the basic tool of all science today, astronomers included. These are the great things that Newton gave us. We understand him perfectly. We know his law of reaction, action and reaction. We understand his law of inertia. We understand his law of attraction between masses. And we understand, above all, his inverse proportion law. And it's the accumulation of these laws with the basic knowledge of the great Dr. Einstein and the magnificent Tesla that we are able to build the OTCX-1 spaceship, which is why we're here tonight. We are, above all, bringing to the minds of people the fact that we have an electrified propulsion system for space travel.
Mr. Carr, I can certainly understand that with these principles so well in mind, when students of physics go through college, they have general cause to memorize the three exquisitely simple and meaningful statements that Mr. Newton made in the three laws of motion. But as they go up and down, there's some basic principles. You wouldn't necessarily want to be able to quote these things.
We don't memorize quotations.
This is what I was thinking, that you wouldn't, wouldn't clutter your mind with direct quotations of things like Newton's laws. But I wonder about the law of inverse proportion, which you mentioned. The law of inverse proportion. I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
This is the inverse square of the distances, the measure of the mass. And that's why every liquid appears heavier than its gas. Ionized particles are floating in the air. Seem to rule the earth, but yet they won't grow a hair on a bald head. This is one of the basics of physics, right?
I see.
I don't know if I infer correctly from your question, but I would like to observe, in connection with memorizing anything or being able to quote the verbatim rules or laws or pros or tables or equations of any kind, I would say, in my association with academic procedures, a great deal of time is wasted in getting people to memorize such things rather than to teach them sources of reference and information when it's needed. So I don't think either Mr. Carr or I feel that there is anything to be gained from having all of these things in our heads that we can pick up out of a page of a book.
Well, this is as I was saying to Mr. Carr. I can understand that he wouldn't want to clutter his mind with a formal memorization of these three brief
we
laws.
We might state just one thing, if it's of any benefit to any of our listeners, that we think mostly with our hands. And when they start to work, and then when we get in the proper association of true feeling, things begin to create.
Satisfies me for the moment, John.
Incidentally, in connection, excuse me, with these little caption lines under the illustrations of these great men of physical science,